In a world that's obsessed with personal freedom, we're witnessing a generation of believers walk away from the church. Many are abandoning their Christian heritage altogether. Years ago, we called it backsliding. The modern term is deconstruction. Whatever label we assign falls short of reflecting our sadness when a Christian retreats. Today, on Insightful Living, Chuck Swindoll continues his biographical study of Solomon. In this message, we observe a tragic pattern of compromise that fueled Solomon's spiritual demise. Chuck called this message, "When the Heart is Turned Away."
I want to read for you a brief biography of a failure. And I would like for you to think with me about who this person might be. It will perhaps surprise you to know the identity. He began his life with all the classic handicaps and disadvantages. His mother was a powerfully built, dominating woman who found it difficult to love anyone. She had been married 3 times, and her second husband divorced her because she beat him up regularly. The father of the child I'm describing was her 3rd husband. He died of a heart attack a few months before the child's birth. As a consequence, the mother had to work long hours from his earliest childhood. She gave him no affection, no love, no discipline, and no training during those early years. She even forbade him to call her at work. Other children had little to do with him, so he was alone most of the time. He was absolutely rejected from his earliest childhood. He was ugly and poor and untrained and unlovable. When he was 13 years old, a school psychologist commented that he probably didn't even know the meaning of the word love. During adolescence, the girls would have nothing to do with him, and he fought with the boys. Despite a high IQ, he failed academically and finally dropped out during his 3rd year of high school. He thought he might find a new acceptance in the Marine Corps. They reportedly built men, and he wanted to be one, but his problems went with him. The other Marines laughed at him and ridiculed him. He fought back, resisted authority, and was court-martialed and thrown out of the Marines with an undesirable discharge. So there he was, a young punk in his early 20s, absolutely friendless and shipwrecked. He was a small and scrawny man. He had an adolescent squeak in his voice. He was balding. He had no talent, no skill, no sense of worthiness. He didn't even have a driver's license. Once again, he thought he could run from his problems, so he went to a foreign country to live. He was rejected there, too. Nothing had changed. While there, he married a girl who herself had been an illegitimate child and brought her back to America with him. Soon she began to develop the same contempt for him that everyone else displayed. She bore him 2 children, but he never enjoyed the status and respect that a father should have. His marriage continued to crumble. His wife demanded more and more things that he could not provide. Instead of being his ally against the bitter world, as he hoped, she became his most vicious opponent. She could outfight him, and she learned to bully him. On one occasion, she locked him in the bathroom as punishment. Finally, she forced him to leave. He tried to make it on his own and was terribly lonely. After days of solitude, he went home and literally begged her on his knees to take him back. He surrendered all pride. He crawled. He accepted humiliation. He came on her terms. Despite his meager salary, he brought her $78 as a gift, asking her to take it and spend it any way she wished. She laughed at him. She belittled his feeble attempts to supply the family's needs. She ridiculed his failure. She made fun of his sexual impotency in front of a friend. At one point, he fell on his knees and wept bitterly as the greater darkness of his private nightmare enveloped him. Finally, in silence, he pleaded no more. No one wanted him. No one had ever wanted him. He was perhaps the most rejected man of our time. His ego lay shattered in a fragmented dust. The next day, he was a strangely different man. He arose, went to the garage, took down a rifle he had hidden there. He carried it with him to his newly acquired job at a book storage building. And from a window on the third floor of that building, shortly after noon, November the 22nd, 1963, he sent two shells crashing into the head of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Lee Harvey Oswald, the rejected, unlovable failure, killed the man who, more than any other man on earth, embodied all the success, beauty, wealth, and family affection which he lacked. In firing that rifle, he utilized the one skill he had learned in his entire miserable lifetime. When we hear the full story of this strange man and all that went into the background of Lee Oswald, we're not surprised to discover that his life became a failure. As a matter of fact, most of us raised in those conditions would find it virtually impossible to turn the tide. I am not justifying his actions by any means, but you would expect a person like that to be a failure. But in contrast, how do you explain a life that was 180 degrees different from that results in failure? It's not hard to explain the failure of a Lee Harvey Oswald, or of a Charles Manson, or of the strangler that ran free in the streets of Boston, or of those still running free today. But how do you explain the strange events found in the last years of a very successful man's life that give the lie to all the good things that had been invested in him? Of course, I'm referring to Solomon, the man who had all the tangible signs of success from the day he was born. I'd like you to turn to 1 Kings chapter 10 as we unravel this strange life that doesn't really make sense. I want you to understand to begin with that he had those four tangible signs of success. If there had been a Forbes magazine or Fortune in that day, I am sure he would have been written up as among the top 100 most successful men of his times. He certainly would have been written up because of his fortune. It is known for a fact that his annual income was somewhere between $25 and $65 million on a regular basis, not counting a number of the benefits that came to him by way of gifts from those that admired him. He was an incredible man of incredible fortune. This led to his fame. Chapter 10, verse 23, we read that he became greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. And all the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. He was a God-blessed man. The hand of God was on him. And people clamored for an audience with this man. He was a man of amazing fame. He also had power. Go back to chapter 4, verse 20. Along with fortune and fame, he was, of course, a man of incredible clout. His power was unlimited. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand that is on the seashore in abundance. They were eating and drinking and rejoicing. Now, Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Verse 24, the last part of the verse, he had peace on all sides around about him. Judah and Israel lived in safety, every man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan even to Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. It's a colloquialism, like we would say from Seattle to Miami, or from Maine to California, from the extremities of that land, this man had power. They all served Solomon. And with it, of course, came pleasure. We've looked at length in previous studies in Solomon's life at the book of Ecclesiastes. There's no reason to turn again. Chapters 2, 3, 4, 6, and 10 declare that he was a man who had unlimited pleasure. He had an extravagance of delights, and whatever he attempted to try or to do, he seemed to accomplish. Along with the pleasures of sensuality were the pleasures of fulfillment. Whatever project he began, he saw completed, and he found no difficulty in meeting the needs for the budget because it was always there in abundance. How in the world do you explain failure in a life like that? Born with a silver spoon in his mouth, the blessing of God, a marvelous heritage, good training at the feet of Nathan the prophet, a model in his father David, who was a man after God's heart. He followed hot after God. How do you explain the failures? Well, I've discovered in the study of Solomon's life some characteristics of disintegration. And in the study, I have seen them clearly set forth in the Scriptures. Chapter 3 of this same book, I want to show you a couple of internal attitudes that began to deteriorate his life. Of course, I have in mind the relevance of all of this today. We're not interested just in Solomon's deterioration. We're interested in how it happens today as well. Chapter 3 of 1 Kings, verse 1. We're going to uncover a couple of these damaging attitudes that persisted in Solomon's mind. Then Solomon formed a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her to the city of David. Remember that. It'll come back to haunt us a little later in the study. He brought her to the city of David. She didn't fit, but he brought her. He was her husband. And to fulfill the alliance, he took her from Egypt and brought her back to the courthouse or to the courtroom of the king. He brought her back to the house of David, to the city of David, until he finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. Now God had said, don't do it, and Solomon did it. Verse 2, the people were still sacrificing on the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. Now they're sacrificing to other gods as well as to Jehovah God. And it says, verse 3, Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. God had declared the danger of that, but Solomon went right on and did it. Remember that. Turn from here to 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 11. These are parallel books, and so we look at them one after another as we study Solomon's life. Chapter 8, verse 11. Then Solomon brought Pharaoh's daughter up from the city of David to the house which he had built for her. Earlier he had a marriage alliance with Pharaoh and married the daughter of Pharaoh, and he brought her to the city of David, but we don't read anything more about it. I take it that he sort of hid her out. He kept her behind the scenes. He didn't display her or flaunt her right now, but he just quietly, after building a house for God and a house for himself, made sure that she had her own dwelling. It's called her house, or the house that he built for her, in verse 11. For he said, my wife shall not dwell in the house of David, king of Israel, because the places are holy where the ark of the Lord has entered. Isn't that something? A woman from an unholy background has no business being in a holy place. So he built her own dwelling, and it was there that he apparently lived and coexisted with her. The first attitude that began to have a deteriorating effect on Solomon was this. He did not take God seriously. Now, this is certainly not a theoretical study. This is so pertinent, I can't believe it. so pertinent for us who have been reared in Christian homes, especially. Those of us who have heard the name of Jesus Christ since our earliest years, fresh out of the crib, right in the church, and sometime while in the crib, raised in the church. Our fathers and our forefathers forged out the faith that has been passed on to us. We gave no blood. We gave no sacrifice. We simply, by being born into the family we were born into, have had this laid on our lap like as if it were on a silver platter. The easiest thing in the world is not to take God seriously. That's Dad's job. That's what Mother does. That's Granddad. He's the preacher of the family. I mean, that's where the roots of our heritage go, and it's there that we have our commitment. Not to the Lord, but to some family member. And therefore, when the chips are down, we don't take God seriously. I've come up with three rather practical reasons why we don't take Him seriously. Number one, overexposure to the things of God. Problem of overexposure. There was never a time in Solomon's life when he didn't hear of Jehovah God, when he wasn't under the sound instruction of a godly prophet, Nathan, when he didn't have modeled before him a good father, not perfect, but a good one. Never a time. He was overexposed, and it led to cynicism. Overexposure leads to cynicism if your walk with Christ isn't kept sensitive. If you question that, frequent many a Bible college in the school year, and you'll see cynicism in the raw. It's not planned to be that way, it just happens. Because the kids that have come to the Bible college often are reared in it, are up to here in it, and they're at the school thinking, somehow this will be a measure of freedom, and while there, they running with others coming from that same overexposure problem fall into that cynical trap. Number one is overexposure. Number two, he was indulged. Too much for nothing, and that leads to irresponsibility. He got everything without a cost. He had to fight for nothing. His dad did the fighting. He got the benefits. And like any good father, some represented right here, gave so greatly in your life, finally made something of yourself, finally found the truth, and when your kids come, your tendency is just sort of give it to them on a downhill slide. And that breeds irresponsibility. Solomon was that. That explains his extravagance. Being indulged leads to extravagance. And so it was with Solomon. A third reason I find from a practical point of view is that he was promoted too fast, too far. He was only 20, not more than 25 years old when he took the throne. And there are not many 25-year-old young men who can handle a nation as big as Israel. That led to professionalism. Cynicism, irresponsibility, professionalism. I got to be careful not to be cynical when I give you this illustration, but I do want to make it really clear. One of the best places to find professionalism is among those preachers who are on the circuit. By that I mean they travel from church to church and from place to place professionally delivering a barrel of sermons. And they have long since stopped doing fresh study. They are not really accountable to any congregation or any board. They just go from place to place. And there comes from them a whole line of cliches, not all of them certainly, but many of them, and just sort of a brassy barrenness that comes out in orthodox yet sterile truth. And if you have been around it, you spot it right away. If you entertain very much, you certainly see it among many of those in my profession. And I'll tell you, it is the easiest thing to fall into the professionalism trap. You're paid to pray, you're paid to preach, and you pray and preach like that because you're paid for it, rather than because you have a burning passion to communicate fresh truth in a fresh way. Well, that was Solomon. He learned how to do it from his earliest years. You can learn that. There's a way to do it. And there are words to say and the right way to say them. And you can just sort of zing your way right in there. And it's everything is just so right. And yet it's so wrong. Very little warmth emanated from Solomon regarding the Lord God. He didn't take God seriously. Let me show you something else. You're in 2 Chronicles. Look at chapter 8, verse 4. He built Tadmor in the wilderness and all the storage cities which he had built in Hamath. By the way, a storage city was nothing more than a place to house the vast reservoir of his riches, things, trinkets, monies, supplies. He had a great storage house or series of storage houses that he built on his own. Verse 5, he built upper Beth-horon and lower Beth-horon, fortified cities with wall gates and bars, and Baalath, and all the storage cities that Solomon had, and all the cities for his chariots, cities for his horsemen, and all that it pleased Solomon to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, in all the land under his rule. Can you imagine? That's what you call open-ended budget, blank check management. You know the second problem with Solomon? He was not accountable to anyone on earth. He got vast riches. He chose to build storage cities. He built storage cities. He loved horses. He chose to get a hold of a lot of horses and with those horsemen. And he had to have stables and places to put them, so he built them. And you never find in the record, I've looked carefully, you never find where he bounced that idea off of anyone else. It says in the verse, wherever he chose to do it, wherever it pleased him, he built it. Now the tendency on the part of the young tonight is to say, that is the way to rule. That sounds great. No, that's great danger. Unlimited freedom leads inevitably to disaster. Unrestricted unaccountability, nobody on earth can handle. I go back to chapter 9 of 1 Kings, and you see it again. He wasn't accountable to any person. 1 Kings 9:17. Solomon rebuilt Gezer in the lower Beth-horon and Baalath and Tamar in the wilderness in the land of Judah and all the storied cities which Solomon had, even cities for his chariots. He was a collector of chariots. What do you do when you run out of things to do? Well, you collect chariots. Some collect coins, some collect stamps. He chose chariots. They were in. That was the in thing in those days. You collected all sorts of chariots, and you read about this supply he had, and all that it pleased Solomon to build in Jerusalem and in Lebanon and all the land under his rule. He had it. There it is. Verse 1, chapter 9, it came about when Solomon finished the building of the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to do. You can read on to see what it says. Just whatever he desired. By the way, he passed on this attitude to his son, Rehoboam, if you remember the record. We'll look at that next time in our study. But when his kingdom failed and he passed off the scene and his son took up the scepter, it says that his son denied ignored the counsel of the older and the wise, and he went with those who were his peers, and they led him astray. Just like his dad. Why should we be surprised? An unaccountable father gives birth and training to an unaccountable son. And when his son came, Rehoboam right away split the kingdom. He was just like his dad.
Maybe you're listening today with a broken heart because a member of your family has abandoned their Christian faith. Please stay with us, because Chuck Swindoll has much more wisdom to draw from Solomon's story. Chuck called this message, When the Heart is Turned Away. At Insightful Living, listeners often tell us how much they value Chuck's teaching on Bible characters. He has a way of bringing men and women of the Bible to life. In doing so, we begin to project our own circumstances and our own emotions onto theirs. Well, this study about Solomon originated many years ago, when Chuck was just beginning his pastoral ministry in California. And while his voice may sound much younger on today's program, it's clear that biblical truth never ages. All six sermons in the biographical series on Solomon have been digitally remastered. And to learn how you can purchase them today, go to insightfulliving.org.uk. Well, the succession of leadership, or the transfer of one's legacy to the next generation, isn't a new subject. It's as old as time. And Chuck wrote a new booklet on this topic. It's called How to Follow a Giant, and we're pleased to offer you a copy today with your donation. Chuck presents an intensely personal message about stepping into big sandals. And using the Bible as his guide, he provides practical counsel for both leaders and those who succeed them. Request your copy of Chuck's booklet on How to Follow a Giant when you make a much-needed donation today. To request the booklet with your gift, just go online to insightfulliving.org.uk. How do we avoid compromising our faith? I'm Terry Boyle. Join us when Chuck Swindoll describes how to protect your spiritual passion on Friday on Insightful Living. The preceding message, When the Heart is Turned Away, was copyrighted in 1978, 1980, 1982, 1987, 1995, 2008, and 2024, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2024 by Charles R. Swindoll, Incorporated. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.